My name is Ellen Cassidy, and I'm an enthusiastic Al-Anon. Good morning. She did very well. She remembered Addison for about 30 seconds. I am so happy to be here. I'm just delighted to be here. I've grumbled about this trip and grumbled about this trip because I spent 11 hours. I spent 11 hours yesterday trying to get here just to be of service to you. And progress, not perfection. And I grumbled about it. And it was a fabulous day yesterday. I had a great time. I had a wonderful time. In spite of myself, I had a great time. And I get on this teeny tiny plane to fly the whole 20 minutes it takes to get here from Seattle. It was such a short trip that the attendant, I'm not making this up, the attendant said from her little jump seat up front with the phone in her face, she said, I don't have time to serve you anything, but if you want peanuts, I'll throw them to you. Hands went up in the plane. It was great. And there was a lady sitting next to me who wept. She wept when the plane landed. She'd only been gone from here 4 days. She'd been in Chicago, though. And she was, when we flew over, she goes, there's my house. I mean, she was so happy to be here. She was just beside herself. She got off the plane and she was dancing. This is some kind of magic place. This is really a, and I had a chance to just walk a little neighborhood this morning. I just got up. This is absolutely breathtaking. It's just gorgeous. But the best part are these people. And I just feel honored to be here and so grateful that God thought it was a good idea. And I wouldn't be here if he hadn't thought it was a good idea. I introduce myself as an Al-Anon, and I would like to explain that to you, but of course I would, because explaining is one of the things I do best. It's of course, part of my disease as well as part of my recovery. I just think this God of my understanding that you have given me, would talk about a sense of humor. Explaining is part of the reason I got to Al-Anon. And now God has made little nests of people all over the country, and he says, go explain, honey. Just explain to your heart's content. And I got a lot of explaining to do. Al-Anon is not what I wanted to be when I grew up. I didn't know there was such a thing as Al-Anon. It was not on the list. What I wanted to be when I grew up was I wanted to be somebody's wife and somebody's mother. And I was going to be the best wife he had ever. And I was going to be the best mother those kids ever had. What I ended up being was somebody's judge and somebody's jury and somebody's executioner. And it wasn't fun for any of us. When I got to Al-Anon, I didn't want to be here, but I didn't want to be anywhere, so that wasn't too unusual. When I got to Al-Anon, I don't know why AA finds it necessary to put the sickest people they have at the door in our area anyway, but that's what they do, and it's those guys that go, hi, welcome to AA, come on in, you know, and just kind of, once they get hold of you, they don't let go. It's like, you know, you're in the room. And there was a guy at the door, hi, welcome to AA. And I went, oh, well, I'm really not looking for AA. I'm looking for Al-Anon. And he, the whole thing changes. He goes, oh. Al-Anon. Oh. And he said, I'm not making this up either. I make up very little. I still make up a little. You won't be able to tell. I'm a professional. He said, to get to Al-Anon, you'll have to go through the big room where the really sick people are. To the little room in the back, where the tables don't exactly match, because we've given them all of our hand-me-down tables. And they're all purse-lipped and blue-haired, and that's Al-Anon. These are the people I want to spend the rest of my life with. And I was in Al-Anon a while, and actually I decided the thing I would really much rather be is alcoholic. And there were several reasons for that. Number one, it really appeared to me that alcoholic women had a lot more fun than we did. And apparently my husband preferred him. So I decided I'd be alcoholic. Now, I did not want to drink to become alcoholic. For one thing, I had no idea how long that was going to take, and I needed to be alcoholic like that afternoon, you know. And to be honest with you, I wasn't sure that I could control it. You know, I've been told that I'm about a about an 8-ounce Coors away from the seat in AA. But my solution to that was the same solution I had to everything else in my life. I thought if I changed how it looked on the outside, it would change how it felt on the inside. So, obviously, all I needed to do was look alcoholic. Now, before I explain to you how I managed that, let me tell you that alcoholic women saved my life. I did not come to Al-Anon surrendered, and I don't think, I can't speak for Al-Anon. They say that, but it's not true. I really can't. I didn't come to Al-Anon surrendered, and I don't think most of us do. I came to Al-Anon looking for one more thing that might work. I came to Al-Anon looking for a little more power so I could get him to be the way I thought he needed to be so I'd be okay. If you're not sure, sitting out there today, you lovely, beautiful people, if you're not sure whether or not you've surrendered, you have not. When that happens to you, it will leave no question in your mind. If you have not surrendered, it's okay. It's okay. Hang around. Your chance will come. And if you miss that one, that's okay too. There's another one right behind it. It'll be a little louder, a little bigger, a little more painful. But you'll keep getting them. They'll keep coming. There's not a shortage of surrenders. I didn't come surrendered. I came looking for one more thing that might work. But surrender happened to me. Almost 3 years into the program, surrender happened to me. And when I hit that place, when I saw the big black hole and knew I was falling in, I didn't have to explain it to AA women. They already knew because they'd already been there. There's a wonderful AA lady at my club who took me aside after a meeting one night and she said, "Honey, those Al-Anons mean well. They have no idea." She said, "What you need is 448 through 452 every day for a month." And I went, "I'm on it. I am on it. I'll do anything. I'll do anything." And I did it. I am a big book Al-Anon. There are parts of this country where that's not acceptable. The big book, for whatever reason, do not ask me, I do not know, is a not approved Al-Anon literature. I personally think it is a bit insane to attempt to work the program without the directions. Hello? And they are in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I have to tell you that I did read it about 42 times before I quit highlighting parts for my mom and turning down corners for him. But on about my 43rd time through there, I was reading this page, or someone was reading it to me, which is often what had to happen, and I went, "Oh my God, they're talking about me. I have the same disease. One of my solutions, however, is not alcohol, but I have the same disease." Anyway, so having told you that alcoholic women saved my life, I am from Addison is a very nice way of saying Dallas. And in gorgeous North Dallas, alcoholic women all looked pretty much the same to me. So my solution to looking alcoholic was to outfit myself that day in skin-tight jeans and stiletto heels. Well, I learned a couple of things from that little experiment. Number one, I didn't like anything control me like those pants did. Number two, Al-Anons are doomed to sensible shoes. We really are built for speed and not looks. If you love an alcoholic, you better be ready to go in a flash. And those shoes, you could hurt yourself in those shoes. You might even lose him, you know, in those shoes. Because he hardly ever looks at your feet anyway. Anyway, so the place where I did this little experiment, because God has his fabulous sense of humor, was at the Crested Butte Mountain Conference, where I go every summer to spend a week with 600 of my closest friends. And that week, I got to spend the week with four people who had between them 125 years of Al-Anon. One of them was Elsa Chamberlain. And I got to not only hear their talks, but I went to meetings with them. I had meals with them. Most importantly, I got to watch how they interacted with their families and how their families interacted with them. At the end of the week, I had the answer to the question that bugged me most of my life, which was, what do you want to be when you grow up? Deep down, I knew I didn't know the answer to that. You know, it implied a couple of things. A, I should know, and oh my God, what if I picked the wrong thing? And two, that I was responsible for my life, and that was really your responsibility, not mine. But I knew what I wanted to be when I grew up. What I want is I want to be free. I want the freedom that's offered me in step three. I want the freedom to be who it is that God would have me be. And I'm so grateful that God has given me a way to get there. And it's the 12 steps of Al-Anon. When I got to Al-Anon, they said I had to quit pronouncing myself, I had to quit pronouncing other folks as alcoholic. And I'm really very good at it. I really am. It's a curse and a blessing all in the same thing. At this school where I used to work, when these teenagers would come to enroll in school, sometimes if they were concerned about the child, they would have me meet with them for a while. And if I thought he was the cutest kid in the world, they'd go, that one, we got to watch him. He's going to be on the way. As a matter of fact, I hadn't been in the program, I've been in 4 or 5 years, I guess, and I was a single mother raising a couple of kids, and my best friend in the program was a single mother, and we needed a little extra cash, and so it was in the year of what color is your balloon or whatever that thing was, you know, you should follow your heart and just do the thing you're really good at and the money will come. So she and I, we thought for a long time about what is it we're really, really good at? Well, the thing we were best at was picking out alcoholics. So we decided we were going to open a little business and we were going to call it Drunken Busters. And here was the deal. If you love somebody and you weren't sure, for a very small fee, because we would love our job, for a very small fee, we would go out with them. And if we came back thinking he was the cutest thing since sliced bread, you'd know that if he didn't have a chip, he needed one. Well, our sponsor wouldn't let us do that for some reason. I'm not sure why, but she wouldn't let us. They said I had to quit pronouncing people as alcoholic, that it's a self-diagnosed disease. But they said, honey, if he walks like a duck and he swims like a duck and he quacks like a duck, treat him like a duck. Other people have been dictating reality to you your whole life. This is where you get to start having your own reality. Treat them like a duck. I suspect the doctor quacked when I was born. I have been around quacking my entire life. And the issue really is not their quacking. The issue is my need to hear the quacking. Because if it gets too quiet, I will hut up a quacker. I don't feel really like comfortable in my skin unless there's quacking somewhere around me, you know. It just, I adore alcoholics. I just think alcoholics are what's the point in these other people, you know? What is the point? I never liked those easy guys, you know. My parents quack. I'm not the only one who's heard the quacking there, but the issue is that there are other people who have not heard the quacking. And you heard our tradition that says the only requirement for membership is that there be a problem of alcoholism in a relative or friend. And it does not say that the relative or friend has to say, I'm an alcoholic. All it says is my botherer is stirred up. My parents quack. I am the oldest of 9 children, and most of the rest of them quack. I have married several folks who quack. I worked for a man who quacked in his office for 13 years. And I am the mother of a quacker. And yet none of these, you know, that's the first part of the first step. That's how I got to Al-Anon. It's because I'm addicted to quacking. What's kept me in Al-Anon is the second part of the first step, is the unmanageability of my own life. Al-Anon is not a program for people who need it. This planet reeks of people who need Al-Anon. You meet them every day. The surly little woman in the grocery store. The rude waitress. The guy who cuts you off. Now, he could just as easily need this program as AA. Al-Anon is not a program for people who want it, even. There are a lot of people who come to my meeting, my home group, and they love the way the fellowship feels. Some of them even love the laughter, and we laugh a lot in my group. Some people are turned away by the laughter because alcoholism is not a funny disease. And if anything I say up here to you today, you hear other people laughing and it's not funny to you, that's okay. You can't laugh about it till it's healed. But if you hear yourself laughing, there's another little healed place, probably with no scar. What happens is these people come to our room and they sit in there and they feel the fellowship in the room and they hear, you know, they will say to us sometimes, gosh, you're so wise. You know such wonderful things. Until we get to step three. Al-Anon has often been accused of being a three-step program. We do the Al-Anon waltz. We do 1-2-12, 1-2-12, 1-2-12. We know what the problem is. We got the answer. Let us tell you about it. All that other stuff in the middle is really just for folks who just don't know like we know. Because step three is the place where we tell folks, if you work this step, your life will change. And we go, oh, no, wait. There's been a little miscommunication here. Did you think I like wanted my life to change? No, actually, you see, my life is not that bad. It was really his life. We're like we're folks in a lake of liquid manure up to about here, and it's not particularly pleasant, but it's comfortable. We know how it got there. It's ours, and we're used to it. You know, we know where the edges of it are, you know, and so we're just hanging in there, and people come along in a boat, and they say, you don't have to live like that, and we can show you the way out. And we go, oh, no. Really, really, it's not that bad. I just want you to keep that guy over there from making waves. Well, now, and you realize, as I did, I'm sure, that the only thing that guy can kick up is my stuff. I would like to draw this big boundary and tell him, don't cross that. Don't you be pushing my buttons. Hello, whose buttons are they? You're responsible for the buttons. See, what happens sometimes at my group is we get to that, you know, people hang around, they come for the fellowship, they understand, we're powerless, blah, 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 there's recovery, yada, yada, yada. And then most of the time in my group, about 99.9% of the time, we really do what it says. And we have to remind ourselves at every meeting that we keep the focus on us and not on the alcoholic, on us and not on the alcoholic, on us and not on... You think once or twice would be enough. No, every meeting we got to talk about that. On us and not on the alcoholic. Oh, yeah, that's right, right, right. And so we don't talk about... Although when my little group first started, and there's an AA group on the other side of us, on the other side of the wall, and we would laugh, and for a couple of months, every time our meeting was over, the door would fly open, and these AAs would come, and they'd go, what were you laughing at here? They thought we were laughing at them, and we really didn't think they were that funny. Anyway, sometimes, very rarely, but sometimes one of us will get started talking about the old days. You know, back when old Frank was, you know, doing his thing. And she'll say something about, you know, she came in one night and he was passed out and she got some fingernail polish or something and poured it into one of his body orifices somewhere, you know, and old Frank woke up the next morning and went, oh my God, and he's been sober ever since, you know, and you watch that little newcomer in the room and she goes, oh. Check ya. You know, and she's out because she got what she came for, you know. And you got to pray for poor old Frank because he's in for a rude awakening in the morning. Al-Anon is really a program for people who are willing to work at it because that's what it requires, is slight, persistent effort. You are not an Al-Anon because you love an alcoholic, or you're married to an alcoholic, or you know an alcoholic. Those people are alligators. I am an Al-Anon. I'm an Al-Anon because I have a 12-step recovery program that I practice like my life depends on it. I am convinced today of the fatal nature of my disease. I'm an Al-Anon because I have a committed meeting I go to every week like a doctor's appointment. If you want to find me, you come to the 6:15 Monday night Addison Al-Anon family group. And when I walk in that door, they go, oh, Alan, there you are. Give me a hug. How are you? And fine is not an answer they will accept. They know me better than that. And when they say, how do you feel? I stop and I feel myself all over. And I tell them the truth about how I really feel. I'm an Al-Anon because I have a sponsor who knows everything there is to know about me. And apparently more. Because I've never told her anything that made her go, You did what? Like my poor mother used to do. She really seems to love me more after I've told her some new thing I've thought up, some new solution I've come up with, you know, than she did before. I discovered in Al-Anon that really the problems in my life are not the problems in my life. The problems in my life are the solutions I've come up with. And we have to say that at every meeting, trying to force solutions. Not just any old solutions, our solutions. You know. Okay, so there you go. I'm an Al-Anon, and I know you're pleased. And here we are, only 20 minutes into the meeting. Well, when I was 17, Mama diagnosed me as boy crazy, and she sent me someplace where she thought I'd be safe, and that was Lubbock, Texas. I know you'll love this. The very first Al-Anon meeting in the entire state of Texas was held in Lubbock because it reeks of it. It's a place where they've told alcoholics they can't drink. So nothing makes them drink faster than telling them they can't drink. So that, you know, I went looking for him. Of course, I was always looking for him. And it took me 6 months to find him. And when I found him, he was married to somebody else and was 60 pounds overweight and had two kids. But none of that seemed insurmountable to me. Like I said, I don't like those easy guys. You know, I don't. I don't like those ones that come up and go, oh, you're really cute. Could I have a... Right for me. I want those ones you have to fight for. You know, those ones you have to make yours. Those ones you have to, like, earn. You know. A year later, we had shed the wife, the two kids, and the 60 pound, and I had my prize. Oh, lucky, lucky me. I've been Al-Anon a little while, and I look at that relationship, and I realize there was something desperately wrong with it from the beginning. I grew up in a family of heavy drinkers. I grew up in a family that acted as if there was something the matter with people who did not drink. Now, understanding that part of my disease is selective hearing, I hear what I want to hear, doesn't mean that I like it. It's just what I anticipate I'm going to hear, and by God, I hear it because it fits into my little world of things, you know. So, having told you that, I will tell you that what I thought I heard him say was, stay away from people who don't drink. They are probably fanatics. They could even be Baptists. And so I stayed away from people who didn't drink. And then I find him. And one of the deals is he's not drinking. He's in a religion that people don't drink, and so he's not drinking. I find that very strange that I would have picked someone who wasn't drinking. But I think the chaos of alcoholism was already a big part of my life, and I was looking for something crazy but stable. Now I have to report to you that by the time we married, he was drinking. It's a pattern in my life you will hear repeated. We'd been married 6 months when he hit me the first time. I didn't grow up in a family where adults hit each other, so the reaction I had to that was not anything anybody taught me. I came up with it in that wonderful place that I come up with all my solutions, right between these little ears. And my solution to that was to double dog dare him to do it again. I'd been in Al-Anon a while. I was like in my second time through the steps before I looked at that and went, wow, that was insane. What kind of deal is that? One of the things I discovered in that little experiment was that it didn't take any more insanity for him to hit me the second time than it did the first time. For some length of time, I volunteered for that abuse by double dog daring him to do it again. At some point, I crossed a line. And I went from the volunteer to the victim. I do not know when it happened. But today, after a number of times through the steps, I know how it happened. Every time he hit me and I believed what he said, which was, if you hadn't done what you did, I wouldn't have to do what I did. Every time he hit me and I believed him when he said, you deserve that. Every time he hit me and I got up the next morning and I looked at myself in the mirror at a black eye or a bloody nose or a swollen lip and I said, it's not that bad. I'll just stay in the house a day or two and nobody will know. Every time I did that, a piece of me left. And it was a piece of me that didn't come back. Until 9.5 years later, because I'm a sticker. I make my bed and by God, I will come real close to dying in it before I decide to get out. 9.5 years later, when somebody said to me, you don't have to live like that, which I'm sure I'd heard many times before, but this one said, you don't have to live like that, and da-da-da-da-da-da, the magic words, I love you. I left, and I did it like I did all my other male relationships. I'd go, love you, love you, love you, love you, got you, don't need you. When I did my first fifth step, and I shared with her what this first husband had done that I called hitting me, she said, honey, when somebody holds you repeatedly under a cabin cruiser in 20 feet of water, that's not hitting. It's attempted murder. But I have this disease called it's not that bad, where I rationalize and justify and make it about me. Because if it's about me, then I got the power to make him different. Now, number two, I'll just number them for you. It's really simpler that way. Number two comes along, and he was perfect. Oh, you would have loved him. He was perfect. He was the right height, right age, right coloring, right family, right job, right education, right everything. He was perfect. Well, there was one teeny tiny little flaw. He didn't come home nice. But I'm thinking a couple of home-cooked meals and a little, and I got it. That's how I mark my territory. And so I followed that plan, worked that solution a while, and I nailed him. But I'm like the Mounties. I always get my man. If I set out for him, they ought to just go on and give in early. It would save us all a lot of energy. But anyway, I got him. And for about a year or so, it looked like my plan was working. God was on my side. Because he kept coming home nights. It was great. And then, of course, because he was a bar drinker. Now, the reason we call them bar drinkers is because they drink in bars. So simple. It really is. It was real confusing to me for a while, but I get it now. He was a bar drinker. And that means that there's going to be a night he doesn't come home. And the night came that he didn't come home. Well, I lay on the floor of the bathroom and I cried because I was pretty sure he'd seen the 2 pounds I gained, and that's why he didn't love me anymore, and that's why he wasn't coming home. And then I pulled my little stuff together and I decided I just needed to go sit out on the sofa and wait. Now, if you're in training for Al-Anon, you must pass through graduate waiting. And you know that you're in graduate waiting if, when you are waiting, you can do nothing else. You cannot cook, you cannot clean, you cannot watch TV, you cannot read a book, you cannot talk on the phone. The children would come up to me and they'd go, Mom, and I'd go, I can't talk to you, I'm waiting. And that's because while you're waiting, you're listening. And you are listening for the sound of those tires. There are umpty umpazillion other tires on the road. Don't matter, don't care. Know the sound of those tires. And because mine, too, is a threefold disease, it's physical, emotional, and spiritual, I would have a physical reaction when I heard those tires. I'd hear those tires, and I'd go, oh, he's home. Now, the next thought may be, I'm going to kill that tire so I'm gone when you walk in the room, you know. But the first thing was, oh. Well, I'm waiting. I'm sitting on the sofa, and I'm waiting. And then I decide, because this is what I do, I decided that if I could just, like, see his truck, I would feel so much better. So I decided to go press my little nose to the window and see if I can see him coming. These are not wrinkles. These are Venetian blind marks. This is the corner, if you've ever been to Dallas, this is the corner of Midway Road and LBJ Freeway. And probably about 10,000 cars every 10 minutes go by there. But that's okay. If you're a graduate waiter, you just watch faster. And then my mind does what my mind does, left to its own devices. I used to call this love. I realize today it's not, but this also was a hard lesson for me. In my mind, all of a sudden I knew what had happened. Oh, my God. I don't know why, but he drove his car out in the country for some reason. I don't know why, but he just decided that he was out in the country. And then all of a sudden, for some reason, I don't know why, but it doesn't matter. This car just like, blew up. It blew up. And it blew his body into this ditch by the side of the road. And these other cars are going by, but they can't see him because he's down in this ditch. And he's bleeding, and his guts are coming out, and he's almost dead. But he's not quite dead. And with his dying breath, he's calling me. love you. And now wild animals are coming and tearing off body parts, and it'll be 7 years before we can identify the body. See, what I like is, what I think is really, really cool about this whole deal is you understand that. You will never see on an Al-Anon room a sign, think, think, think. And that's because we see think, we think obsession. If you let us think, that's where we go. Obsession. An obsession is an obsession until in your mind somebody dies. Until you take it all the way till they're dead. I heard an AA say one time that the reason it says think, think, think is you can only think about it three times. If you, once you get to four, it's obsession. God, I'm so grateful for that. I like those hard and fast rules. Anyway. Well, I'm here to report to you that 99 times out of 100, alcoholics come home. It may be that day or the next day or 3 years later, but they come home. And when he came home, I was at the door like a three-year-old who's been crying all afternoon, and you've said, stop it. You know, I was at that place, you know. And just snot slinging everywhere and swollen eyes. I think about that picture and think, no wonder he drank, you know. If that's waiting for me at home, I'll just have another, okay. I met him at the door. I asked the second stupidest question we ever asked. Stupidest, of course, is, have you been drinking? Second stupidest is, where have you been? Because actually the only answer that would have saved me, would have satisfied me, would have been in a ditch bleeding. Really. And he looked at me and he went, oh my God, what happened to you?
I've just been so worried. I didn't know where you were, and I've just been so worried about you.
Oh my God. Your address is in my wallet. Anything ever happens to me, you'll be the first to know. Well, thank you. I feel so much better now. And then he said, you knew where I was. And you know what? I knew where he was. He only went three places. He was either at home, at work, or in the trap room drinking. But I have the ability to hold opposing thoughts in my head, and they never touch. And the two thoughts were, he loves me more than anything in this world. He told me that. My life hung on that. And the other one was, he's in the trap room drinking. But if this one's true, that one can't be. And in my dis-easiness, I would rather wish him dead than acknowledge the truth. And he said, if he wanted me home, all I had to do was call me. Even I knew that wasn't going to work. And he said, I don't know why I stay married to you. You're crazy. You're as crazy as your mother. And I said,
I'm sorry.
Now, what is the matter with this picture? He is 3 hours late, drunk, and I'm saying,
I'm sorry.
We marry alcoholics hoping we're going to change them. They marry us hoping we're never going to change. Al-Anons fall in love with people's potential, you know. We just think it's up to us to dig down there and get it out, you know. Well, okay, so now you see that the real problem here is I have an addiction to mind-altering people. They're the ones who would say to me, isn't the sky a lovely shade of brown? And I go, oh, brown?
Oh, right, yes, I think I do see some brown.
And by God, I do. I see brown over there. Ooh, ooh, it's not a good way to live. Well, I rocked on here married to the, you know, the perfect guy with the little flaw for a number of years. And then this woman called me at work one day, and she was a woman who I was very afraid of because she was an angry woman. And she was angry all the time. She always talked like that. She called one day at school, and she said, I want to ask you something about my child. She told me something, and if it's not true, I'm going to rip her lips off. I mean, I really, like, believed her. And I thought, for a long time, I thought I was afraid of angry people. What I've come to learn in Al-Anon is I'm not afraid of angry people. I'm afraid of my own anger. I had never allowed myself to be angry. I had turned it all to the inside. All I ever did was hurt. It was the only feeling I had when I got to Al-Anon was hurt. I just hurt. Of course, I'm happy to report that I have been angry a number of times in recovery. And the first time it happened, I called my mother and went, "Oh, my God!" And she said, "Wow, what's going on?" I said, "I don't know, but I'm going to kill somebody." She said, "Oh, good." Well, I said, "Well, what am I supposed to do with this?" She said, "Nothing." Nothing! Well, I have learned a little trick. I just get a pasteboard box and kick the snot out of it all around the house and call it names, and I feel so much better. Anyway, this angry woman called, and she was crying. Now, the primary Al-Anon illusion is when you're okay, then I'll be okay. I will go places in my diseasiness. I will go places I don't want to go with people I don't want to be with. I will stay up when I'm tired. I'll eat when I'm not hungry. I won't eat when I am. I'll sit up all night with your sick mother when I don't like sick people, and I sure don't like your mother. It looks very loving and kind on the outside, and it's the most self-centered behavior on the planet. I do not do it because I care about you. I do not do it out of the kindness of my heart. I do it because I need you to be a certain way for me. I need you to be okay. And in my diseasiness, I will lie, I will cheat, I will steal. I've been told that maybe the greatest thing we do for each other in Al-Anon is we tend to each other's pain. We don't tell each other when we start having a hard time, "Wipe that look off your face, Missy. Go to your room, and when you can get a better attitude, you can come out here with the rest of us." In my little group, we really practice this. We have boxes of Kleenex that sit around the table. But if somebody starts crying, we don't shove the Kleenex at them. We sit still, and we let them cry. I've learned in Al-Anon that everything, every day, every relationship, every book, every feeling, everything has a beginning and a middle and an end. But if I'm not willing to get past that beginning, if I'm not willing to get into the middle, I will never get to the end. And a lot of us come to Al-Anon so hurt, so angry, so confused that we are terrified to start crying. We're terrified to start feeling again because the feeling is if I ever start, it'll never stop. It will take over me. So little pieces at a time, when people start crying, you know, you watch newcomers. The one thing that most newcomers do is they sit in the meeting and they cry. They look fine when they come in. And they may laugh through a couple of people until it's their time to share. And then they go, "Hi, my name is..." And they just weep. You know, they just weep. I thought I was... I remember saying about 6 months into Al-Anon, I remember saying, "Oh, I'm so sorry. This is all I could do is cry." They said, "That's okay. We're the sponges. Go ahead." And they let me cry a little bit at a time, a little bit at a time. We don't, in the meetings, we don't pat each other on the back. If somebody's having a hard time, we keep our hands off. We let them do what they need to do. We don't tell them it's going to be okay. You know what? I'm not supposed to tell you when I get up here what it's like. I'm supposed to get up here and tell you what happened and what I'm like today. Because there are a lot of times that it still sucks. And that's not the difference in my life. The difference in my life is not the it's, although it sounds like that. The difference is me and how I respond to things rather than react to things. We do know, and we can tell them, you're going to be okay. There is an end to this. This too shall pass. As a matter of fact, it came to pass. That's the whole reason it's here. So this woman calls, and she's crying on the phone, and she says to me, "My husband is in a 12-step recovery program for alcoholism, and as part of his recovery, we're going to pay this school all the money we owe you." She's crying. I'm an alligator. I'm feeling very diseasy, and I lie to her. I say, "I understand, because my husband drinks too much, too." Now, the problem was not his drinking. It never was his drinking. The problem was he didn't come home. But see, I wasn't going to tell anybody that because I thought that was about me. I thought if I was a better wife, he'd be there. If I was somehow different, I'd be enough for him. And if I was enough for him, then I was going to be enough for me. I was talking to somebody who is new in Al-Anon, and we are deadly when we're new. She was evangelizing for Al-Anon. And for months I lied to her. My grandmother got sick, and things were just wasn't that bad. And then the day came when it was that bad. And that's what will happen if you live in active alcoholism. It will get that bad. And I had to turn myself into her, and she took me to a meeting. And for a long time I didn't tell him I was going to Al-Anon. And then it came out, and I told him I was going, because I went during the day while I was supposed to be at work. They didn't care at work. I was pretty useless at that point. So I told him I was going, and at first he was very angry because what will people think? Now here's the guy who came home at 2:30 in the morning, 2 o'clock the bars close. He comes home at 2,
with the air conditioner on full blast so that he's like icy. You know, it's like ice dripping off of him when he gets home because he's got to keep himself awake till he gets there. And he insists on backing in. I don't know why. That garage, to this day, he would back in, wham in, slide back a little. And then, as often as not, would pitch forward and pass out on the horn. And this is the guy who doesn't want people to know, you know. Anyway.
Would you hit me one more time? You know, thank you now.
Then, after a while, he decided it wasn't so bad that I was going to Al-Anon. He decided, as a matter of fact, thank you, that it was so not so bad that one Monday morning I got a call from a woman who said, I want to talk to you. Your husband has been here with my husband all weekend drinking. And I said to your husband, how can you do this? How does your wife put up with this? And he said, you found a way and I should call you. He was 12-stepping for Al-Anon, you know. Because Al-Anon had told me, get off his back. Leave him alone. Let him do what he needs to do. Don't cause a crisis. Don't prevent a crisis. Keep the focus on you and not on the alcoholic. Keep the focus. Oh, yeah, that's right. So we rock on. She came for a while, but she really needed to be angry, and she wasn't willing to give that up yet. So she had to go back, and we still pray for her. So we're rocking along, and then we went through a difficult time. And that's what happens in alcoholism. Alcoholism is a deadly disease. It kills relationships. It kills sweet romance. It kills the people who have it, and it kills the people who live with it. Statistics are, and I don't know why I feel the need to explain this, but I do. Statistics are, for every alcoholic, there are 10 to 42 people directly affected. That's a lot. I'm not sure who that leaves on the planet, actually. But if that's true, then Al-Anon ought to be 10 times bigger than AA, at least. Ain't a happening thing. It ain't a happening thing. It is hard to go to a meeting for something when you don't have any problem. Most of us had to be in Al-Anon long enough to realize, whoa, I got a problem. You know, you got to hang around because we keep the focus on us and not on the alcoholic. The focus on us and not on the alcoholic. So I'm rocking along in Al-Anon, and it happens. And we go through a difficult time. And I find out at the end of this difficult time that he's having an affair. The insanity in my life was I knew he drank, I knew he did drugs, I knew he gambled, I knew he hung out in a bar, but I always thought he was faithful. At the time, it was the biggest illusion I had, blown to hell, you know. It was the biggest illusion I had, and I called my sponsor, and I went, oh, my God. She said, it has nothing to do with you. Beg your pardon? Has nothing to do with you. He's got a great, huge hole, and it's a God-sized hole, and he can't fill it up. But he's trying. He's trying with alcohol. He's trying with drugs. He's trying with gambling. And now he's going to try with other women. It has nothing to do with you. What it made me have to deal with was the real reason I got into Al-Anon. I would have told you that I came here because of my husband's unacceptable behavior. The truth of the matter is I came to Al-Anon because of my own unacceptable behavior. I had turned into somebody I didn't know, somebody I didn't like, and somebody I couldn't trust. I was married to the man of my dreams, and when I came to Al-Anon, I was having an affair, and it wasn't my first. I would like to report to you it was real close to my last one. Progress, not perfection. And I'm way past it today, so you're cool. Don't worry. And I had to deal with the reality of that. We separated. That's what happens in alcoholic homes. And he came home. And the night he came home, he had called me and given me a sob story. And I said, of course you can come home. And then I knew my sponsor was going to kill me. And I picked up the phone after a while and turned myself in and told her what I'd done. And she said, you know, she said what my sponsor has always said to me. She said, oh, honey, you just did perfectly. You know who it is who ties me up in the bondage of self? That would be me. It isn't you. That's me that does that. And she has always, always set me free. And he came home the next night, and my best friend in the program's husband, my sponsor's husband, and another guy they thought ought to be with them came over and they 12-stepped him. She didn't send him. I didn't invite him. But I had been told early on that one of the best things I could do for my own recovery was to attend open AA meetings. Because when the man I love talks, all I can hear is my own pain. When I listen to somebody else talk, I could finally begin to see where the disease stopped and the man started. And I could learn to not like the disease and feel safe enough to love him again. Because that's what happens to us, is it doesn't feel safe to love them anymore. And they knew me. They knew me from open AA meetings, and so they came. And a remarkable thing happened. He quit drinking. But he went to meetings, and he would say, there's some guys there who would say they were court-appointed alcoholics, and he would say he was a wife-appointed alcoholic. People say, do you have a topic? Yes. How do you know you're an alcoholic? We went searching for a treatment center one time that would be appropriate for him. And he would have to question them, and he would say, how do you know you're an alcoholic? And he was looking for like a date, or an age or a gallon or a something, that if you've done this much or this long, or then you're an alcoholic. And they would come up with these big explanations. But the last place we went, the guy looked at him and he looked at me, and he said, you know what, I cannot tell looking at you, but I can tell looking at her. And I burst into tears. It was the first time somebody in the earth world had acknowledged how hard it is to love an alcoholic. We say in our opening, living with an alcoholic is too much for most of us. I always want to say, well, the one of you that it wasn't too much for, please stand up. In the course of that, I know nothing but long stories, and I'm going to try to keep it relatively short today. So let me just tell you this part. Let's just jump to the big finisher. I was 38 years old. He'd been sober 2 weeks. It was New Year's Eve. Boring, 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 boring. With a New Year's silly guy. 10:30, we're going to bed. And I discovered a lump. Now, I should have gone to the doctor in September for my checkup, but I was so focused on him. So into making him okay so I could be okay, that I didn't do the things I needed to do to take care of myself. Should have gone in September, didn't go. Found a lump. First thought was my Ellen thought, which was, oh my God, I can't tell him about this because he won't be able to handle it. Second thought was my Al-Anon thought. This is yours to handle one day at a time. 1984 was the year I did cancer. I did all of cancer. There's no history of cancer in my family, of breast cancer in my family. And I did all of cancer, just like I've done all of alcoholism. I did the surgery, I did the chemo, I did the radiation. If you have to give up a body part, go for boob. Ain't a big deal. You can do anything with one, you do with two. At my age, pretty much all they're good for is holding up clothes anyway. And you could do that with Kleenex if you really needed to, boob was not a big deal. It wasn't a big deal even then. And hair was a pretty big deal. Giving up my hair was really a hard thing to do that year. But it was how I met God. Because the day, it was the middle of the summer, I'd lost, now I won't be graphic, but I had lost all the hair on my body. All the hair. Okay, you got it? So I got to wear this, except the gray, which was like these little nerve endings that blew around here. So I wore a little hat so I wouldn't offend you with my gray. And I was getting ready to go out to go do something, and it was the middle of summer, and I looked down and realized that I had lost all the hair on my body except under my arms and on my legs. And I was going to have to go back in and shave my legs. And I just, that was the moment I got it. That was the moment I got it. I was living with a guy who would say on Friday morning, what's for dinner? And I'd say, oh, I don't know. And it would be pork chops, because those were his favorites, so I always said pork chops. And he might not come home till the next Friday, And I had a hot pink and neon orange daughter who was crazier than crazy. And I had a beige and navy blue son who was disappearing a little piece at a time, disappearing, disappearing, disappearing. I had a 60-40 chance of living another 5 years. The doctor has said it doesn't look good. And yet that day, standing at the back door, I laughed out loud. I finally got one day at a time. I finally understood that right that minute, I was fine. I was fine. Hardest thing I lost that year was him. I'm one of those people who can't live life without written directions, and I'm so grateful that when I got to Al-Anon, they said, this is it. There's 12, it's it. It's simple. We're not going to show you one, you do that perfectly, we'll show you the next one. This is it. There's a whole thing. We've all done it. Come on. And I've hung my life on a couple of lines out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. One of them is nothing but nothing happens by accident in God's world. And the other part is the last column in the four-step inventory that says, and what was your part? Which leads me to understand that there are not some things in this world that I have a part in and other things where I'm just the victim. I love that. Victims don't recover. Don't you love it? It leads me to understand I have a part in everything. And my sponsor had convinced me that I was responsible for my part. And that's all I had to do was my part. I wanted to know what my part was in the cancer. Only way I knew to do that was to work the steps. I got in a closed-step study and I worked the steps. What I came up with at the end of that was, when I live in active alcoholism, I break out in malignancies. I have more details, of course, if you want them later, but suffice it to say, that's that. That's what I came up with. And for the first time, I was able to say to him and mean, if you can't stay sober, you can't stay here. Because he'd been drinking. He stayed sober about 2 months, and then he'd start drinking again. And he said, let me think about it. No. Not let me think about it. And he left. And if you'd asked him why he left, he would have told you it's that crazy daughter of mine that anyone that had to live with that little woman would drink too, you know. About 2 years later, they called. I knew there was something the matter with her. I knew there was. This is the kid who would come home. She came home one Saturday morning, and she should have been home Friday night. Now, do you see the pattern in my life? She came home Saturday morning. She's like, oh, my God, Mother, what was it? Oh, my God, we're driving down the freeway, minding our own business. We're not bothering anybody. And this car just tried to, like, knock us off the road, Mom. We don't know who they are. We don't know who they came. And the police came. And the police said it wasn't their fault or anything. And, of course, by then, I'm, oh, my God, oh, my God. Everybody okay? Yes, Mama, I'm fine, but I'm kind of tired. I think I'll go to my room. And I'm in the living room going, and I'm pretty sure she's crazy, right? So they call from school one day and they said, there's something the matter with your daughter. Duh, Anna. They said, we're going to send her for an evaluation. Oh. 2 days later, a guy at the treatment center says, hate to tell you this, we're pretty sure your daughter's an alcoholic. And I went, yes. And they said, we don't have a lot of mothers react like that. Oh, yes, alcoholism, yippee. I thought he was just crazy. That's an Al-Anon disease, takes forever. No assurance she's ever going to get any help, but alcoholism, yes. She's 17, I can make her do stuff, you know. So I took her to a place that would force feed the 12 steps into her because I knew that was the only thing that worked. More statistics. As much as I love alcoholics, there is no way I can thank you for my daughter. There are not words to tell you how grateful I am for what you've done for her. The statistics are that 80% of the young people who come in have to go back out because they're not finished. And if you were in this for some kind of recovery percentage, you know, that could be awfully depressing. My daughter was one of those statistics. She stayed sober about a year and a half, and she went back out because she wasn't finished. She went some places I know about and a lot more places I don't know about and don't need to know about. She left the state. She called me one night, Mom, I got to have $300 by the morning or the dealers will. And I had to say, I don't have the $300. I can't give it to you. On January 29th of 1990, my daughter walked back into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had nothing to do with it. And you had everything to do with it. Because you didn't treat her when she came the first time like she was too young, like she hadn't suffered long enough. Like because she did drugs, it somehow negated her alcoholism. You recognized another suffering soul, and you loved her. The best thing I ever did for that kid was get a program, get a life, and get out of her way, and let her do what she needed to do. She's got 11-plus years of continuous sobriety, and she got sober before it was ever legal for her to drink, you know. I just find that totally amazing. About 4 summers ago, my daughter graduated from the University of California at Hayward with a degree in criminal justice. Oh, I just think that's so funny. She did time in every little jail, you know, in our area. And she worked, actually, she was an intern for the San Francisco Police Department for a while. And Dallas doesn't want her the police department there finds her a little tainted. But San Francisco thought she was fabulous, you know what I mean? And so, here's this crazy daughter out doing her thing, and so she started, when she was sober the first time and she started hanging out in slippery places with slippery people, I could see the writing on the wall. And I knew that the way it felt was, if she drinks, I'll die. That's how it felt. And I, one more time, for the umpteenth time, I said, if you don't do this and this and this, you cannot stay here with me. But for the first time, I had, the power had been added. And I knew that she couldn't stay there with me. And the morning came. I had planned it for the morning I was leaving for Crested Butte to be with 600 of my closest friends because I knew I was going to need intensive care. I wanted her healthy, happy, whole, and home. And she was none of those things. She was in a lot of trouble. And that morning she threw herself across my bed and she said, you're going to be a grandmother. She was 18. And I thought that changed things. And now I'm the responsible party and I'm going to have to take care of her. And I thought I'll die. And after a couple of hours of ranting and raving at her, I called my sponsor and turned myself in again. And my sponsor said, do you want her to stay? I said, no, I don't want her to stay, and I feel terrible about that. She said, don't feel terrible. There are only so many bad feelings in each situation. Those are hers. Let her have them. If you don't want her to stay, I'll stay on the phone while you tell her. And I quit hurting. I thought the pain was in letting her go. But the pain was in holding on when it was time to let her go. I think the name of this planet is let go, let go, let go, let go, let go. And she moved out. And we went through an interesting fall. And I would go, I was at the Brazos Riverside Conference, and my friend Buddy Ross was taping, and I told Buddy, you know, what she'd done to me now. Now she's pregnant at me. And Buddy said, you know, our son's girlfriend had a baby out of wedlock, and that baby has been the light of our lives. You know what? It never occurred to me I might like it. It never occurred to me. I think the sanity offered me in step two may be nothing short of paradise. But the reason I don't get paradise is because I say, yeah, but. Not today, God. Not this child, God. Not this many pounds, God. This many pounds can't be happy. My journey in Al-Anon has been the journey from yeah, but to thank you. Thank you for things just the way they are. Al-Anon has allowed me to change my mind. I love babies. I have always loved babies. God was offering me another baby, and I was going, yeah, but. And I decided to say thank you. My attitude changed, and we got on a different foot. A couple of months later, she called me, Ma, had a sonogram today. Blue blanket you're knitting? Knit faster. Twin boys. Oh, yeah, if one is good, two are better. It's another fabulous story I could spend all day telling you, but I shan't. Anyway, I'd never seen a new baby before because both of my babies were adopted, and I told the nurses that at the hospital, and when the twins were born, they brought them into the little nursery thing, and they tapped on the window, and they said, come on, Grandma, come on in. And they let me go in and hold her. My friend Beverly B., from Louisville, Texas, had happened by the hospital that day. They were like 5 weeks early, and she happened by the hospital. She stood outside the window, and we were both crying because we were so happy. And the babies were crying because they were really mad. And I'd cry, and I'd hold the baby cried, I cried, barely, I cried with them, but hold the other baby. You know, the program gives you people to share the pain so it doesn't hurt so much, and people to share the joy so it's multiplied. Every year on the boy's birthday, she sends me a birthday card. 2 months later, her first grandchild was born, and because of the disease of alcoholism, she wasn't allowed to be there. But she was there with mine, and I had two, one for me and one for her. When the boys were 5 weeks old, my daughter said, Mom, I can't do this. I cannot do this. I'm going to have to give them up for adoption, and if you want them, you can have them. You know, one of the things that's really painful is if you would like to watch Al-Anons try to decide where to go for lunch. Oh, I don't care. Where do you want to go? I don't care. Where do you want to go? Thank God there are double winners who come up and go, Mexican food, we're going for Mexican food. Oh, thank you. Yes, and off we go, you know. Because we're so afraid of making the wrong decision, you know. And this one was like one of the biggest decisions I'd ever made in my life. My sponsor had been telling me that God wants for me what I want for me in my heart of hearts. I was afraid if I turned myself over to God, he would send me to, like,
you know, Slobovia to minister to the heathens or something, you know. But God didn't send me anywhere I don't want to go. He doesn't. She said, your job is walking in the direction of your dreams. Where you get is God's deal. And God's promise to you is this or something better. Not something worse. This or something better. God is not waiting around the corner to test my patience. He is not. He doesn't have these little grenades that he just drops on me from time to time just for kicks, you know? That's why the word in step three is care of God. Not the whim of God, but the care of God. So I decided what I wanted. I didn't want to be their mother. I'm through raising kids, and they're the children of two addicts, and I don't like the odds. She moved out, gave me power of attorney, and I went to adoption agencies, and I said, I'm looking for a family that wants two babies and a grandmother. And they said, there are no guarantees, you know, that's up to the adoptive parents. I said, really, it's not, but that's okay. I thought it would take a couple of weeks, and it took a bunch of months. And my precious, adorable son was in the summer before his senior year, and he helped me take care of those babies. One of them had a heart problem. I had a full-time job. He was going to summer school, but he was there helping me do that. The night before we gave him up, he said to me, Mom, you know what? If you could just keep him one more year till I get out of high school, I'll get a job and I'll support him, and we don't have to give him up. He said, Mom, I'm never going to wonder again if my birth parents loved me. I know today how much they love me. I walked into Lutheran services, and I said, told them what I wanted, and they said, we know just the people. We know them. They don't care that the boys are almost 5 months old. They don't care that there's two of them. They don't care that one of them's got some heart trouble. They don't care that the family wants to stay involved. Their reaction was, whatever God's will is, that's what we'll do. And my daughter and I said, we'll take them. We picked them. A year to the day after my daughter announced that I was going to be a grandmother, because they let me pick the day, and I knew that I needed to be with you to get through this. So on my way to Crested Butte to be with 600 of my closest friends, my son and my daughter and I and our babies went to Lutheran services and turned them over to their new parents. Every reason I had for keeping them was about me. Every reason I had for giving them up was about them. My boys were 13 years old this March the 15th. There has never been a month in their life that they haven't seen me. I am their grandmother. I've always been their grandmother. The relationship I have with their parents is not anything I could ever explain to you. Ruby is older than I am. They are not Barbie and Ken. But we don't have a family tree. We have like this vine. About 3 years ago when my daughter was pregnant and giving birth to she and her husband's first baby, that was the first time it occurred to the twins that there was something different about our family. That their grandmother was younger than their mother. And they started asking questions, and we finally explained it to them, and they were like, oh. And I went through a year of them coming to see me and staying with me, of them saying, why'd you give us up, Grandma? Why didn't you keep us? Don't you wish I was your little boy? And by the end of the year, I could say to them, you know why I gave them up? Because I wanted you to have a grandma. I wanted to be one, and I wanted you to have one. If I'd been your mom, you'd have had no grandma. There would be no special place. There would be no one who would love you no matter what you do. But now you got her. And they're, you know what, they're happy with it, and it rocks on. They were 18 months old when their parents called and said, guess what, another girl has given us her five-month-old baby, and this one doesn't have a grandmother. I thought, you know, in the process of giving them up for adoption, I'd lose them. I not only did not lose them, I gained a granddaughter. And she's mine as surely as they are, you know, just as surely as they are. About the time the boys left, I decided I was going to give up dating. I had gone through a stretch of doing the steps, and I had discovered since I was 12 years old, I'd either been chasing after, catching, going with, dating, engaged to, married to, divorced from, engaged to, married to, divorced from, somebody. But there'd always been somebody. My great big hole was beside me. And I decided I was never going to figure out who I was if I was always hooked up with somebody else. And I'd like to tell you that the day I decided to quit dating, that I had to go to the front steps and say, sorry, boys, I've sworn off. But apparently God and I decided about the same day. Now, if you're not going to hang out with guys, it leaves you one other choice, and they were not my first. I really have never liked girls very much. They are the opposition. They like to do girly stuff, which I don't like. I shop like a man. You know what you want? You go in, kill it, get it out. But all that up and down the aisle crap, that'll drive you nuts, you know. Talk on the phone, no. Email. That's my kind of thing.
But I decided I'm going to hang out with the girls. And I call the girls up and I say, we're going to the conference. I got this big Suburban. I want you to come go with me. It's 3 days. You need 7 pairs of shoes for 3 days. It's okay. Bring all your shoes. I don't care. Every time you have to pee, we're going to stop the car. Don't care if it's been 10 minutes later and if the only place you'll pee is McDonald's. It's okay. Every time we pass a Walmart, we're going in. I think there ought to be, like, a Red Cross that hangs in the front of Walmart. Healing happens there, I know. And I hung out with the girls forever. And you know what I discovered? I had always wanted God to speak to me in burning bushes. I want this big, huge thunder and lightning thing. In case you can't tell, drama is my life. And God said, Ellen, you know what? I'm going to smoke a few for you. But I am not going to set any on fire. Because one more time, if I did that, you'd get lost in the messenger and you'd miss the message. God speaks to me in the language I understand best, and that is another woman. What I discovered in that little adventure was the most amazing thing of all, and that is that I am enough for me. Nobody has to be added to make me okay. Nobody has to be added to make me enough. I'm enough for me. And then this guy asked me out, and he didn't match the list, and I said, okay, I'll go. I'd known him a long time. He wasn't in the program. I was not marrying anybody who was not sober. He asked me out, and so we went to dinner, and we're married now. But like the first year we dated, our whole physical contact would be, he'd walk me to the door after a date, and he'd go, see ya. I'd call my sponsor, and I'd go, there's something desperately the matter with one of us. And she'd say this thing like, are you having a good time? Well, yeah, but what if? And she'd say, don't worry about what if. Have a good time. When we get down the road, if something happens, we'll deal with it when it happens. Have a good time. So we rocked on like that for a while, and for like 4 years we dated. Hello? I mean, we like really dated. And then we got married, and people said, oh, look, you got a normal guy. Well, no. I knew he wasn't normal. I knew he had this, like, overeating thing. And that's all I need to know. You got an obsession? Great, you're perfect for me. Come on. Come on, come on, come on. And I'll practice not messing with you, you know. Just practice. And if you're going to hang out with me, you're going to hang out with you. So he ended up at meetings, you know, and he thought we were a little strange. He said, oh, there's so much emotion, I can't do that. The other thing he said was, I've never seen people who care so much about each other. And so 1994 was a hard year. I won't go into all that, but it was a hard year. And by October, I was crazy as a bedbug. And my sponsor had made me do a written first step, and I sat down at dinner at the Brazos Riverside Conference to give her my written first step. And the first thing I was powerless over was his snoring. Loved him, but I was going to have to kill him. Number two was his drinking. He was not an abusive drunk. He didn't stay out late at night. What I wanted to turn over was his coming home and me opening the door and going, hello. And if I smelled alcohol, my night went to hell in a handbasket. I wanted to know he could drink and I'd be okay. An hour later, he walked up to the podium, said he was an alcoholic, took a chip, and he hadn't had a drink since then. The place went crazy because, of course, they all knew him, you know. They went crazy. They're crying and they're slapping me on the back. And one of my good friends was behind me and she grabbed me and she went, God, you're a carrier. Three C's. Didn't cause it, can't control it, can't cure it. I got more to tell you, but I'm not going to. Ha, ha, ha. Have to come and ask me later. I'm just going to tell you I'm doing the job of my dreams right now. Right now, my job, it's not a job. I can't call it a job. I have, every day from 6 in the morning till 6 in the evening, I take care of my 4 youngest grandchildren. A 4-year-old, a 3-year-old, a 2-year-old, and a 1-year-old. I wanted babies, and God went, my husband said I couldn't do it because we needed money for my old job, which was ridiculous, but I hung in there. And he heard an AA speaker one day say, how much money would you have so you wouldn't feel financially insecure? And he said, well, I guess just enough so I wouldn't have to trust God. And when he heard that, he went, ooh, I guess you can stay home. So I'm in heaven. I used to think that when I died and went to heaven, God was going to say, pull out the VCR and the tape, and I want to know how her husband and her children turned out. And if they turned out to be fine, upstanding members of the community, she has done her job and earned her way into heaven. I'm so grateful that she allowed me to find another God. I'm not exactly sure what's going to happen when this little body of mine gets tired of doing whatever it is we're doing here. And that little part of me that's always been God's goes to wherever it is God is. But one of the things I do when I don't know what's happening is I make up little stories in my head and I live there. This one my sponsor says is okay. I think what might happen when I get there is he's going to go, "Oh, Alan, there you are. Why would God greet me with less love than you do?" And he's going to say, "Oh, baby, you know, heaven's heaven when you're not here, but it's just not perfect without you." And he's going to say, "I've been running a little experiment down there. Nothing even pass or fail, just a little experiment. And I know you've been paying close attention to what's going on, so I'd like to know how it's working. Number one, did you have a good time? You know, there was nothing I did to torture you. There was no reason for flowers to be different colors except I thought it would make you smile. And I knew you'd love babies, so I put lots of them in your life, and I hope you didn't miss any of them. Thanks to you, I'm going to be able to go, oh, thank you, God, for asking me to your party. I had the best time. The best time." And the second thing he's going to say is, "Were you Ellen? You know, you're the only one like that I made. I had things for you to do because my hands are too big." In my written 10-step inventory that I do every night for a couple of years, I would write, "Today, Ellen." And I would write down what I did that day that I knew was mine to do. This was mine to do today. You could have had another speaker, but you didn't. You had me. This was mine to do today. I know I did my Ellen thing today. And the last thing he's going to say is, "Sweetheart, did you ever get the joke?" You know, I got the joke in what could have been considered the worst time of my life. In the middle of cancer, I got the joke. I have spent so much of my life focused on what I'm afraid I'm not going to get or what I'm afraid I'm going to lose that I almost missed what I had. I almost missed what was here. I almost missed the next miracle. There's a guy in my group that says, the glass isn't half empty or half full. The glass is too damn big, which is about my expectations. Bill Cosby says the glass is either half full or half empty, depending on whether you're drinking or pouring. And what you've allowed me to do today is pour. My cup runneth over, and I thank you. Oh.